Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. The FBI has information that warns of nationwide protests at state capitals in the days leading up to and on the day of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. To date, nothing major has materialized, but just in case, security at many state capitals is on high alert. Governor Gavin Newsom deployed the National Guard in recent days to keep watch over the Capitol in Sacramento. There is an increased police presence as well at the Nevada State Capitol in Carson City. Here to walk us through what's still expected for demonstrations and really how we got to this point is Cap Radio's government reporter, Scott Rodd. Scott, always great to talk to you.
Glad to be on.
Also joining us is Cap Radio's Reno Tahoe reporter and producer, Bert Johnson. Hey, Bert.
Hey, good morning, Randall.
So, Bert, let's start with you. You've been keeping an eye on the situation in Carson City. What have you seen in recent days?
Well, I was there on Sunday, and absolutely zero armed protesters showed up in a group in front of the legislative building, which is where a lot of these far-right pro-Trump demonstrations have been held on a weekly basis for the last several months. According to the Reno Gazette Journal, there was a small protest on Saturday. These protests do tend to happen on Saturdays every week. But, you know, some of the expectations or fears of authorities here in Northern Nevada were not met. You know, these were small, very mellow events. And I think part of that is because some of the far-right figures I follow online were a little bit confused about some of the announcements that came out last week, you know, essentially encouraging people to show up for armed protests. These announcements weren't attributed to anybody that anyone knew about in the movement, according to what I saw. And so some of them essentially said, this is a trick by Antifa. They're doing this to make us look bad. Do not go.
Interesting. Give us a update or some insight into the legal situation in Nevada. Can you bring a gun and stand outside the Capitol in Nevada?
Yes. So when we talk about armed protests, essentially every protest I've been to in Carson City has been an armed protest because this is an open carry state. And, you know, for their part, local law enforcement are not super concerned about it because it is just part of everyday life here. That said, I think they do tend to keep an eye on the folks with the guns while they're there. But yeah, it's not out of place to see an AR-15 in a protest in Nevada.
All right. And of course, there's been increased media focus over the last few days, so that might have kept some people away as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Scott, you've been following protests at the Capitol in Sacramento since Election Day. How have you seen those demonstrations evolve, especially in recent days?
So we've been seeing protests going back to, you know, basically Election Day. It's been two months of weekly protests, and just about all of them have gotten violent at some point. Just to paint a picture, typically there's a large protest of Trump supporters and QAnon conspiracy theorists who are out there promoting the conspiracy theory that the election was stolen. And so on the outskirts of that, though, those larger protests typically remain peaceful. On the outskirts, though, you have warring factions, so to speak, from different groups, typically far left demonstrators, some folks who are aligned with Antifa. And then you have far right groups, prominently the Proud Boys, but also you'll see folks like the 3%ers and the California State Militia out there as well. And those are the groups who are, you know, butting heads, to put it mildly, brawling in the streets at times. And, you know, in recent weeks, we've seen less of it. However, there has been violence on January 6th. There was violence on the outskirts of some protests happening at the Capitol. And in recent days, in the last week and a half, we haven't seen, almost 2 weeks, we haven't seen any protests. However, we've seen a much bigger law enforcement presence here at the Capitol. And we're talking about barriers erected around the Capitol building, CHP out in full force. Sacramento police with a very heavy presence, and then also the National Guard as well, standing by, some with long guns, you know, near buildings, near the Capitol, near essentially critical infrastructure. So you're seeing a much more heightened presence of law enforcement standing by.
Scott, when the demonstrations were larger, how many people are we talking about? I know it would just be an estimate, but on both sides.
You know, it's tough to say, and it also it could be pretty dynamic and change week to week. But the core protest of Trump supporters, I would say maybe 200 to 300, and then on the counter protest side, you might see, you know, a couple dozen to a couple hundred, maybe up to 200. So it really varies. You know, I hate to make predictions ahead of time because you typically are proved wrong. But I would say tomorrow, I would expect protests to come out. It's hard to guess just how big, but what I'm seeing from chatter online and talk with some folks, I do think that the protests will materialize tomorrow, unlike this past weekend, where, same with what Bert said, there wasn't any sort of protest showing this weekend at the California Capitol.
Yeah, but maybe something like we saw several weeks back or months ago. Bert, you've done extensive reporting on the far right and Proud Boys. Tell us a little about how those groups moved from being really in the shadows to now where they are protesting openly on a regular basis.
Yeah, the Proud Boys emerged in 2016 as essentially a street fighting gang that was supporting the Trump candidacy. And just to give a little bit of context about the organization itself, you know, this is a white supremacist organization where violence is required to advance within the ranks. So part of their mission while they're out in the streets is violent confrontations with Antifa. And so to achieve the final rank in the organization, which is called your fourth degree, you either have to engage in a fist fight with Antifa or you have to be arrested for the cause. So the Proud Boys, you know, got their start early on in sort of the Trump movement, and they gained strength and followers during some of the violent protests we saw early in the Trump administration. So, for example, the series of violent protests in Berkeley, sometimes called the Battle of Berkeley, a lot of the clashes in the Pacific Northwest, like in Portland. And they also have alliances with other organizations on the far right, including some of these paramilitary groups like the Three Percenters. And generally speaking, you know, they have this membership that's built on these myths of male precarity. So they were pretty successful in taking some of the followers of the men's rights movement and kind of activating them to pursue far right politics and also violence in the streets. So they were a strong presence at the insurrection, and typically they have kind of a uniform. There's actually some reporting that suggests they were wearing different clothes during the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol to kind of throw people off the scent. But, you know, according to the videos and photos I saw, I definitely saw plenty of Proud Boys in their kind of classic black and yellow color scheme. Mm-hmm. And finally, another thing that contributed to the insurrection we saw at the U.S. Capitol is what's called the insurrectionist idea. And I talked to Josh Horwitz about this. He's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. And he says the insurrectionist idea basically says the Second Amendment gives individuals the right to influence public policy with violence. So in other words, if elected leaders do something that people don't like, the far right believes that people have the right to intimidate those leaders with their guns.
Wow. That's an interpretation I haven't heard before. So, Bert, I'm curious, based on the violence that is perpetrated with this group, and you're reporting on this group for quite a while now, have you ever had any threats against you regarding your reporting?
You know, I've gotten negative reactions. I have been very fortunate so far to where I haven't. It's been a long time since I was threatened directly in person. Mm-hmm. Along with my latest reporting, you know, like I said, I go to these protests in Carson City a lot. So I have had some people express their displeasure with how we've reported on the scene. But I've been really lucky.
Yeah. Well, what can we expect on Inauguration Day? What message is the far right getting from President Trump, who will not be in attendance at Joe Biden's inauguration?
Well, first of all, Trump saying he's not going to go to the inauguration sends the message that the Biden administration is illegitimate to the hardcore pro-Trump extremists. In the context of things like the QAnon conspiracy theory and also the decades of misinformation that have been built up on the far right, this looks like a significant move. They're always looking for something that will suggest that their conspiratorial worldview is accurate. And so Trump breaking with tradition in this way could be seen along those lines. And all along, while he's been in power, he's been the far right movement's connection to that seat of power. That's part of why they rioted at the U.S. Capitol. And then I was actually listening to a far right conspiratorial type of podcast this morning just to get a temperature check. And the host for that program said Sunday through Wednesday will be the longest days of our lives. And then according to Josh Horowitz, who I spoke to about the insurrectionist idea, you know, that idea, that part of this movement has been behind a lot of the kind of high level confrontations with the government over the last several decades, including the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. In that case, that bombing really turned public opinion against the movement. And then I asked him, you know, does he think that the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol will do the same thing? Mm-hmm. He says he doesn't think so. He says we're in a different situation.
The fact that people like Jim Jordan and Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley could go back to their respective chambers and make the argument that we're still talking about a disputed election at that point tells me that we're in a different place as a country and that we haven't had our Oklahoma City moment. And frankly, I'm not sure we're capable of it.
Scott, what are some of the biggest concerns for Sacramento come Inauguration Day?
Well, let's go back to January 7th. I think if you ask folks in law enforcement and CHP, they would say, well, we don't want to see what we saw in D.C., which is people trying to storm the Capitol here. So they erected, you know, a 6-foot fence around the Capitol in addition to barricades, and you have a much heavier CHP presence on the Capitol lawn. So I think that was a major concern. It seems like that's pretty well secured at this point. So looking ahead to tomorrow, I think probably the biggest concern is, you know, having warring factions, so to speak, of different types of protesters out there with their own ideas, their own agendas, their own purpose for being out there, ultimately clashing, because these situations can turn very, very fluid, very dynamic, very quickly. And once that threshold of violence is crossed, it's very hard to then contain it. And we've seen violence in week after week here in Sacramento. And again, if there's a large showing tomorrow, there's no reason to suspect that once again, violence will occur.
Cap Radio's government reporter, Scott Rodd, also Cap Radio's Reno Tahoe reporter and producer, Bert Johnson. Thanks to you both for this update and stay safe tomorrow.
Thanks, Randall.
Thank you.
So tomorrow does mark 2 weeks since the United States Capitol was breached by that large group of insurrectionists looking to stop the certification of Joe Biden's presidential victory. The mob really only served as a delay as the process of certification was carried out later that night and then into the wee hours of the morning. Many in Congress on both sides of the aisle believe President Donald Trump incited the violence on January 6th with ongoing unfounded claims of voter fraud, culminating in a speech given just prior to the security breach. As a result, the House of Representatives presented and approved an article of impeachment against the president. Congresswoman Barbara Lee of Oakland, who represents California's 13th congressional district, was one of the first to call for impeachment, saying on January 6th, Trump is the single greatest threat to our democracy. He is unfit for office and can't be trusted for another minute as commander in chief. He must be impeached and removed from office immediately. Again, that was on the 6th. She joins us now to talk about where we stand and what she'd like to see moving forward. Representative Lee, we know you're very busy. Thank you for carving out a few minutes for us. Welcome to Insight.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
You wore your sneakers to the Capitol back on January 6th. I assume that's not your typical attire. Can you help us understand what you knew that day that spurred you to wear shoes that allowed you to run at a moment's notice?
Sure. And I didn't have specifics, but anybody who had heard the noise, read the chatter, knew what the right-wing white supremacists were up to. I mean, this didn't just start this month, but historically, what had been transpiring through Donald Trump's presidency and his campaign, actually, and then recognizing how Donald Trump in the last few months has really pumped up the fact that he does not believe that Joe Biden won. In fact, he told lies and really escalated his rhetoric. And then on the day of the lies, and then on the day of the, on January 6th, incited violence. And I saw this building up. And so I knew, again, not knowing what, but I knew something was going to go down. I mean, because this is a white supremacist movement, they're domestic terrorists. And we know who they are and how they operate, but the government has not taken them seriously and put them in the same category as international terrorists. And so it was a really harrowing experience. Unfortunately, the command of the Capitol Police evidently did not understand the intelligence. They did. I mean, if I could figure it out, why didn't they? And so fortunately, they've all resigned. And the Capitol Police officers did, quite frankly, quite heroic. They actually acted in many heroic ways. Mm-hmm. The Black police officers were, and they told me, and I know them because I've had a lot of security issues in the past, that they were fighting to protect us. They were fighting to protect democracy. They were fighting to protect the Capitol, and they were fighting to for their lives. They were fighting right. These white supremacists. And we're called the N-word over and over and over again. And these white supremacists were in battle with our Black police officers, which is just another example of the type of racism that is in the DNA of this country.
Congresswoman, what's changed for you since that day? Do you see America any differently than you did before?
I see the country beginning to understand what I think African Americans have known since the beginning of our time here as enslaved Africans. We've been dealing with domestic terrorism forever. When you look at what has happened during the Civil Rights Movement, look at how John Lewis was beaten. When you look at the four little girls who died in a bomb blast in Birmingham, we can cite case in point for, you know, years and years and years. And so I think what has changed is now domestic terrorism, as we know it, as Black people know it, now maybe the rest of the country will believe us that this exists and that there are white supremacists who really do not see a multiracial society as being conducive to white supremacy and what they believe as their country should look like.
So even after the events at the Capitol, seven of your colleagues, California Republican representatives, voted to oppose the Electoral College certification. How do you move forward with your California congressional colleagues who voted this way? And is there a path toward healing?
Well, that's a shame and disgrace, first of all. And they should be ashamed of themselves, quite frankly, because that tells me they believe the lies that that Donald Trump has been promulgating. And they have been following him, not just now, but lockstep throughout his entire presidency. And we know that Steve Bannon and Gorka and Steve Miller and all of these white supremacists and white nationalists are around him and advise him. And so for the California members who voted to not certify the Electoral College are complicit with Donald Trump and with what has happened throughout the course of his presidency, not just now, but with all of the terrible things he has done, including locking up children at the borders. And so you can't go through and heal without telling the truth and without being accountable. You know, there's no peace without justice. And so we're going to have to find a way to work with them, but they're going to have to come forward and really acknowledge that Joe Biden is the president, that they were wrong, and that they truly want the country to be a country of justice and of nonviolence and of bipartisanship and of working together to unify the country. But you just can't say, let's move on and heal and get a slap on the hand and that's it. I mean, my gosh, you know, these young people who are incarcerated for marijuana offenses, they have penalties to pay that are unjust in terms of our laws. And you're going to tell me that these members of Congress can get away with it just with a let's heal now? No way.
Congresswoman, I'm wondering how you believe the impeachment proceedings will play out in the Senate. This just came in from NBC News. It's a quote from Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader or the former Senate leader. The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people, and they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like. That just came in, and I'm wondering your take on that and how it might portend what we might see in the Senate.
Well, this was an attempted coup. This was a violation of the Constitution. This president is a clear and present danger. He's a national security threat, and he was the one who incited this violence that ended up with five people dying, an attempted coup, and has helped organize now a stronger white supremacist movement. And he must be held accountable. And I hope Mitch McConnell, encourages and gets his caucus in line to vote for impeachment. I mean, that's the only option, really, to hold this man accountable.
Mm-hmm. Before we let you go, I know you have a short time frame here. I do want to get your thoughts on tomorrow being such a historic day. This new administration on so many levels is breaking barriers, starting at the top with the swearing in of Vice President Kamala Harris, the first person of color and the first woman to serve in that position. Of course, she's from your very area there in Alameda County. Also, we have Alex Padilla set to take over her Senate seat as the first Latino to represent the state of California in the Senate. And Javier Becerra is also set to become the first Latino to leave the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And so what are your thoughts on a day like tomorrow?
Well, first, I'm excited for the country that Joe Biden will be president and Kamala Harris from my congressional district, born in Oakland, raised in Berkeley, will be our vice president. Also, I supported Kamala. I was the first member of Congress to support her when she ran for the presidency. She's experienced. She's smart. She's passionate. She cares about people. She knows the challenges that ordinary families have in this country, and she knows their aspirations. And so I am just so excited about her, Senator Padilla, and soon-to-be Secretary Javier Becerra. I've known all of them, especially Javier. I served with him in the legislature and then in Congress. And I've known Kamala for many, many, many years. And Padilla, since he's been our Secretary of State. And so all three of them are really breaking many glass ceilings. And I tell you, I got involved through the campaign of the first African-American woman elected to Congress and to run for the presidency, Shirley Chisholm. And I know that Shirley Chisholm is smiling and she's saying this is long overdue, but I know she'll be there with us. And Kamala is really, living out and showing us that the aspirations of young girls of color, young Black girls, young South Asian girls, that they have a shot at whatever they want to do, whether it's president, vice president, whatever, that she's broken another glass ceiling for all of us in this country. And for that, our country is going to be stronger as a result.
So many Californians in seats of power that we just mentioned there. Also, Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi continuing on as Speaker of the House. Congressman Kevin McCarthy, even as the minority leader. What does this mean for the state in the years to come?
Sure. And then we have Eric Swalwell and myself as co-chair of our Student Policy Committee, which really is sort of an insider operation, but it's a leadership position where we determine the policy of our Democratic caucus and the committee assignments and all of the other really important jobs that we have. So we have a lot of Californians doing great things. And our speaker, I think, has shown us how smart she is, how strategic she is, and how tough she is. And she's going to make sure that everything is addressed in a bipartisan way. That's always been her first priority, to try to bring unity, of course, within our caucus, but with the Republicans. And also, she knows that we have to work on behalf of the people, for the people. And if bipartisanship, if they just won't cooperate, for example, on COVID relief, we're going to have to figure out how to do it, because the American people are suffering. They're living on the edge. Our businesses are closing. Our schools need to open up. And we're going to do what we have to do on behalf of the people. And I know Speaker Pelosi is all in, and she's all in for bipartisanship, but she's also all in to make sure the people not only survive during this period, but thrive.
Barbara Lee represents California's 13th congressional district, and we really appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Thank you very much. Nice being with you.
All righty. Up next, we take a closer look at security preparations in Washington, D.C. and our own state capitol leading up to Inauguration Day tomorrow. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Our big conversation today is how the pandemic and security concerns have shaped President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, which takes place tomorrow. The FBI warned last week of nationwide protests at state capitals in the days leading up to and on Inauguration Day. Nothing major has materialized thus far, but security at many state capitals remains on high alert. That includes Sacramento, where Governor Gavin Newsom deployed the National Guard to keep watch. And at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., some 25,000 National Guard troops will be on alert tomorrow, troops that are reportedly being vetted by the FBI out of concern there could be an insider attack or another threat from service members. Richard Cohn is a history professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he specializes in defense and national security issues and joins us now to talk a little bit about this. So welcome to Insight, Professor Cohn.
Thanks, Randall. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here, and hopefully you can shed some clarity on all of this that's happening. What do you make of the National Guard and security presence currently at the U.S. Capitol?
Well, I think there's a good deal of uncertainty, and as a result, the security institutions and organizations don't want to be caught off guard. And we don't have, I don't think they have a fully accurate picture of the rightist extremism in this country. You and your reporters have mentioned a large number of them. So the first thing to do is to have an overwhelming presence to protect the Capitol, protect the ceremony, and protect the government leaders there. And second of all, to intimidate any groups that might want to protest in a sizable way or turn violent. So that's really what's going on. And unlike January 6th, the Secret Service is in charge. It's a national security special event, and there's coordination between all the dozens of security agencies of the federal government and local government there.
Given all the planning that was taking place in plain sight on social media sites that reporters were accessed easily and knew was happening, is it a surprise to you that Secret Service and some of the other security arms of the U.S. government didn't realize what was planned to happen on January 6th and that there wasn't a larger presence there to confront it?
No, I wasn't surprised for a number of reasons. In some ways, it was a failure of imagination. Disorders in this country are dealt with at the local level, the state level, and then the federal level. But the federal level has to come in as a last resort and usually deals with the situation. But in this case, it was the federal level that was the problem. This was an attack on January 6th, an attack by one branch of the government on the other branch of the government that was trying to complete the election in its formal terms. And so there was no kind of coordinating agency. There was no command and control at the center to really protect the Capitol or to protect the city in general. And so it wasn't surprising. I mean, I recognized that a week to 10 days ahead of time, what happens if you turn the system upside down and it's the federal government, indeed the presidency's, that the problem? But Donald Trump called for those groups to assemble on January 6th. He said it'll be wild. And so how do you deal with that when your basic intelligence comes from a federal law enforcement organization, particularly the FBI? And there was warning. But as again, I say, there was not coordination planning for what could have happened.
So the FBI is vetting the thousands of National Guard troops that will be on guard tomorrow at the U.S. Capitol out of concern there could be an insider attack. How normal is that?
That's pretty abnormal because National Guard and military people and police are vetted, but the vetting is superficial. They really look at their background. They look for any indicators for a security clearance ahead of time, but it can be out of date. And for sure, they don't have the time with 25,000 guards people there to check social media and see the extent to which some one or more people could be radicalized in the last week, month, year, whatever, or they have relatives or friends who are in these white supremacist and radical right groups. So that's why they have to have a large presence. And when they have to give some quick training to the guard to recognize insider threats, and why I think you'll see some extraordinary security measures being taken against all the way from lone individuals trying to act as snipers, all the way to groups of people trying to break through and make an incident that will get news.
Mm. We just heard Congresswoman Lee say that, you know, several of the leadership positions with the Capitol Police, those people have stepped down following what happened on January the 6th. What is the role this time around for Capitol Police, given what happened nearly 2 weeks ago?
Well, my sense is that they will be protecting the building, and they will be inside the building protecting the members of Congress, the House and Senate, which is their primary job. But they're available as a police force, as well as the Metropolitan Police are there. Since the Capitol Police are something like the ninth largest police force in the United States, they have well over 2,000 people. They have the capability to protect the people inside the building. And I think that will be their primary mission.
How does the National Guard go about coordinating these kinds of protections, like where they should go, what they should protect, where they should have concentrations, all of that?
Well, the National Guard in general is trained for crowd control and to suppress domestic disorder. And you've got guards people from all over the country. Last I heard, it was from 50 states and from the district. And so it depends on what specialized units they send. The coordination comes from the National Guard commander and also from the Military District of Washington, which is really responsible for the regular forces in the area. You don't hear much about them because they try to stay out of sight unless something really awful has happened and it's necessary to mobilize them. But they learned their lesson in the first week in June in Washington, that they've got to be ready In fact, for odd orders that would come from the White House.
Yeah. Are there enough Guard members to go around? Security isn't just high in Washington, D.C., but also at many Capitol state houses around the country. How does the Guard, you know, choose who's going where, and how do they work with local and state law enforcement?
Well, they belong to the governor of each state, and that's set up on a state-by-state basis. They do have enough people to go around. You also have in these state capitals, you have the state police, and you have the local police forces. So my sense is that there's always an incident commander. It might be a guardsman. It's likely to be a guardsperson if they are the rather larger group involved. But I think it's done on a state-by-state basis. You have directors of public safety. There are all kinds of ways to organize it. Mm-hmm. But the whole point is that at these various levels, the security forces have to be coordinated, and they have to have a unity of central command.
So we know that the Capitol siege on January 6th spurred all of this security and protection that we're talking about. How does it compare with past events, like 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, 9/11 terrorist attacks, and so many others? Where would you put the current situation historically?
Well, I would put it as highly unusual. As a historian, I don't like to say unique, because someone will always find something in the past. But this is an internal threat, and most of our security agencies are designed to deal with foreign threats. Most of the time when you're dealing with domestic disorder, you're not talking about an attack on a government installation or building or institution. You're usually trying to suppress a disorder that's broken out spontaneously or planned in the streets, or clashes between different groups on the streets. So I think this is a really unusual situation. Mm. I mean, you probably have to go back to the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln twice in the Civil War, when there's worried about an internal threat from Confederates, spies or assassins, which are close, in the states that are close.
Right.
But of course, Northern Virginia was controlled and Maryland controlled by federal forces. But in this case, you don't know who's who. And I think the security forces are well advised to be in massive there, to be have plans, and central command.
Such unusual times. Richard Cohn, history professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning on everything that's going on.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Still ahead, the history of presidential pardons, its use by modern presidents, and President Trump's use to this point. To date, the president is reportedly prepared to issue about 100 pardons and commutations. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. As Joe Biden's inauguration draws closer, so does the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. This would be the first time that a former president faces a Senate trial. Last week, we talked with University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law professor Leslie Gilo Jacobs about how the impeachment process works. Unfortunately, we ran out of time during that segment, so she's back to pick up the conversation where we left off, and that is to tackle the issue also of presidential pardons. You can listen to the first conversation from last week online at capradio.org/insight or wherever you get your podcasts. Professor Jacobs, welcome back to Insight, and thank you for your time once again.
Happy to be here.
So in his first year in office, Donald Trump pardoned Joe Arpaio, the former sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona. What did that signal about how he would use the power of the pardon going forward?
Well, of course, we have the benefit of hindsight as well. And so certainly the way that he has used the pardon power is to pardon people who either advance his political agenda, who are connected to him, or also people on television, celebrities seem to get his attention as well. Mm-hmm.
There are pardons and then there is granting of clemency. What is the difference there?
Those are actually the same thing.
I mean, okay.
A pardon takes away the punishment and the person gets everything back that they would otherwise.
Uh-oh, we just lost Professor Jacobs. So she was getting into the situation with the types of pardons that the president can do. Donald Trump, to this point, has pardoned 94 people over his 4 years in office and plans to pardon, anyway, that we know of, between 60 and 100 more people. That is expected to happen today, his last full day in office. And so when we get Professor Jacobs back on the line, we can ask her about what kinds of offenses the president can pardon. There's also something called commutations. I think that was what we were trying to define there with Professor Jacobs just a moment ago. I do want to let you know as well, since we don't have Professor Jacobs on the line, that at any time, you can hear Cap Radio Insight either live online through capradio.org or using the Cap Radio podcast for Insight, which is available anywhere you get your podcasts. And those pop up not long after the show is done, like within about an hour. So, okay, we've got Professor Jacobs by phone now. Great to have you back on the show with us. So you were getting into the differences, how a pardon works. And then what I was looking for a distinction between was a pardon and a commutation.
Exactly right. Yes. And so the commutations that we saw happening were by President Obama, who actually reached out and asked people who had high sentences for low-level drug crimes to apply. There actually is a pardon attorney under the Department of Justice, and so you can apply there and say, I have this disproportionate sentence, would you please commute it? And then a commuted sentence reduces the sentence, but it doesn't take away the conviction or the things that happen afterwards, as opposed to a pardon. Which takes it all away.
With a pardon, do you admit to guilt with that? So moving forward, if you were pardoned, do you still say you were guilty, or is it just completely erased?
Well, there's a dispute about that. When Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon, he said that his understanding was if Nixon took it, he was admitting guilt. And so that was one of the reasons he said, okay, look, at something's happening to him here. But afterwards, President Bush, for example, the first President Bush said, no, I don't think so. I'm pardoning people who I think didn't even do something. Mm-hmm. So that's up for grabs, whether indeed you're admitting it. Another thing, if you take a pardon, you can lose your right against self-incrimination, which is something to remember and maybe in a president's mind as well, right, which is anything that you're pardoned for, you, in fact, would have to talk about. You wouldn't be able to be held liable for it, but other people could be. In other words, the information you had couldn't be protected.
I see. Professor Jacobs, what kinds of offenses can the president pardon? Is it limitless?
Federal offenses, but then it's limitless. Although the crime has to have happened. That is, he can't say, I'm going to pardon you for anything you might do ever in your life. The crime has to have happened, but it doesn't have to have been charged.
Huh. So if something is also chargeable at the state level, even though the person may have been charged federally, a state could still move forward with those crimes.
Absolutely. And often that happens. The same facts that would form a federal crime would also form a state crime. And in fact, against this current president, charges are pending, at least in New York. And I know they're considering it other places.
So we mentioned just a moment ago that the president does plan to pardon between 60 and 100 additional people today, his last day in office. What makes the president's pardons different from his predecessors?
Well, the thing that is different about his is the way that they circle around his own interests. And also, they haven't gone to the pardon attorney as much as other presidents have. And so it does seem to be a personal type of appeal that you make to the president himself that gets you a pardon. Although that's not exclusively true. I think he's also planning on pardoning people who might more traditionally fall within the guidelines, which are people who have disproportionately high sentences. And so he's doing this kingly thing. It comes from history of granting mercy.
So the president has access to a pardon attorney who can help vet potential pardons?
Yeah, so there's a whole process set up in the Justice Department, which actually should take over a year. It goes, you give your application, and then the pardon attorney looks at it and compares it to the standards of other pardons, and then makes a recommendation to the president. And often that's how presidents will make most of their pardons, is through this process where the pardon attorney is taking a more general view over the whole nation and over, you know, how justice works, to try to point out some sentences that seem particularly unjust.
Mm-hmm. But President Trump has not closely followed that system?
Has not closely followed that system. I mean, I'm relying here, the Lawfare blog, a couple of professors have done a study about, you know, where his pardons are coming from, and has determined that you know, most of them are not coming through the pardon attorney process, and most of them are centered on these various different factors that I talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of speculation, Professor, that the president will pardon his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and his three eldest children, Don Jr., Eric, and Ivanka. There are no criminal charges against any of them. So you said that a crime needs to have been committed, but I guess it doesn't have to have been charged yet.
Exactly right. Right. And I mean, I'm going to disagree that he's going to pardon those people. I'm not sure he's going to. And we shall see. That is, there is this problem. If indeed the president pardons you, there's this public impression that maybe you actually did something. And at least the kids may want to say, you know, keep an idea that they didn't do it. You know, I'm going to point out as well that I think that it's interesting what Mitch McConnell has done here by saying that he might possibly consider convicting the president in an impeachment trial. I would say that that might limit what the president does with his pardon power, because he doesn't want to, you know, add fuel to the fire of getting Republicans to in fact vote to convict him.
Yeah, we should mention that that what you're referring to there, Professor, is Senator Mitch McConnell said today on the Senate floor that, quote, the mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people, and they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like. That quote comes from today. Let's shift a bit to the impeachment for a moment, since we're on that. We're currently still unclear on when the trial will begin, as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not yet transmitted the article of impeachment, as I understand it. Once the article is sent to the Senate, then how soon does the trial start?
Well, once it's sent to the Senate has an obligation to start it right away. So I have to imagine there's negotiations going back and forth between Schumer, who is now the majority leader, and McConnell, who's just barely the minority leader, but still has a bunch of power, about how exactly this is going to proceed. The president wants to get his nominees confirmed that because of a procedural device, any Republican senator could stop that from happening in an expeditious manner. So I'll bet there are all sorts of conversations going on about this for that and how the timing is going to go.
Yeah. Leslie Gilo Jacobs is a Justice Anthony M. Kennedy Professor of Law and Director of the Capital Center for Law and Policy at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning. And I appreciate how quickly you hopped right on the phone to get back with us.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that mix-up, but I'm glad to be here.
All right, Professor. Thanks. We look forward to speaking with you again in the future. So that is Insight for today. Learn about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. And a big thank you, as always, to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Our technical director is Mark Jones. The engineer behind the board this morning, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow is the inauguration, so Insight will not be on, but we will be back with a fresh show for you on Thursday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.